We read earlier from Luke's Gospel, chapter 14. We read verses 1 to 24. And it's that passage I want us to think about tonight. The passage has a single theme running through it. It's about feasts, banquets, special dinners, and it's about the people who are invited to them. The passage falls into four sections. In the first section, we're told about an episode which happened at a feast, at a special dinner. And then the next three sections tell us about three parables which Jesus told concerning the great feast. So firstly, an episode that happened at a feast, and then three parables which Jesus told about the great feast. We looked last week at, was it last week? No, the week before. We looked last time at the first section, the strange episode which happened at a feast. The feast was held in a Pharisee's house, the house of a prominent Pharisee. Jesus was invited to dinner in this man's house. The Pharisees, as we've said before, were the most religious, the most moral people in that whole society. They were the people who took their religion very seriously. And especially they were the people who were determined to keep all the rules and regulations of their religion as carefully, as meticulously as possible. And especially they were very concerned with all the rules of cleanness that they had drawn up. They were very concerned never to come into contact with anybody or anything that they regarded as unclean. Not physically dirty, but taboo. Anything which they felt would defile them in God's sight. They were especially concerned that they should never eat with anybody who was unclean, that they should never share plates or cups with anybody who was unclean. If they hold a dinner party, then the people they invite to the dinner party are the people whom they regard as clean, the people who they think are worthy to sit down with them. They're conscious that they are the clean ones. They're the people who have separated themselves from all defilements. They're the people who have met God's standards. They're the people who meet all the rules of their religion. And they're going to make sure that they have no contact with unclean people. They're going to make sure that they never sit down at the table with anyone who's unclean. And yet, as Jesus goes to this feast in the home of this prominent Pharisee, look, behold, in front of him there's a man suffering from dropsy. He's not sitting at the table. The Pharisees would never have allowed that. This man's got a horrible, ugly medical condition. His body is grossly swollen with excess fluid. And in the eyes of the Pharisees, that makes him unclean. And yet they've allowed him to come into the house. There he is suddenly in front of Jesus. He's there so that the Pharisees can test what Jesus will do. It's the Sabbath day. Will Jesus heal this man on the Sabbath day? We're not going to talk tonight about the whole question of the Sabbath and Jesus's teaching about the Sabbath and how the Sabbath is to be used. What I want you to think about is just the attitude of these Pharisees. They are so sure of themselves. They're so sure that they are the clean people, that they are the people who meet God's standards. They are the people who are fit to sit at the banqueting table. And they're so sure that this man isn't. They're sure that this man falls short. And it's obvious from his outward appearance. They just look at his outward appearance and they say, this man doesn't count. This man isn't worthy. This man has no place at the table. From their point of view, he's subhuman. They would no more think of inviting him to the table than they would of inviting an animal to the table. Jesus puts the question to them. Don't you show concern for animals? If an animal falls into a pit, aren't you concerned about that? No, they've got less interest, less concern about this man than they would have for an animal. They're clean. He's unclean. They meet God's standards. He doesn't. They're worthy to sit at the feast. He's not. Jesus, we're told, takes hold of this man. Jesus puts his hands onto this man's swollen body. This man whom they despise, this man whom they call unclean, Jesus isn't afraid to embrace him. Jesus isn't afraid to hold him. And Jesus heals him. And then Jesus sends him away. He's not going to let this man sit with these people at this table. But it's not because he's unworthy to sit with them. They are unworthy to sit with him. Jesus has cleansed this man. And if Jesus has cleansed this man is truly clean. This man truly has been fitted for the presence of God. While these Pharisees, these proud, self-satisfied Pharisees, are still unclean, though they never knew it. That's the episode with which Luke starts this section. That's the incident from which everything flows through the rest of the passage. Jesus starts from what's happened in that room at that meal, and he goes on to tell three parables about the great feast. What do I mean by a parable? We often use the word parable specifically to mean a story. We've got lots of examples in the Gospels of Jesus telling stories. And those stories have hidden meanings. But a parable doesn't have to be like that. A parable, in Bible terms, is any saying that has a hidden meaning. Something that you need to puzzle out, or something that you need to have explained to you. It could take the form of a story, but equally it could take the form of a question. It could be what we would call a riddle, a clever question where you've got to puzzle away at it even to understand what the question means. It could be a narrative. If you go to the book of Psalms, you find that one of the psalmists tells the history of Israel. And he says it's all a parable, meaning that you're not going to get the point of it. You're not going to understand what's going on. You're not going to understand the pattern in it unless you really puzzle away at it. There's a secret thread that runs through the story. Jesus here is telling parables. He's saying things, but he's saying them in cryptic, mysterious ways. As I say, he's going to tell three parables. It's only the first of them that's explicitly labelled a parable in verse 7. But all three of them act as parables in different ways. And they are all parables about the great feast. Every Jew who knew his Old Testament knew that one day there would be a great feast, because the Old Testament said so. Every faithful Jew knew that at the end of time, when this world passes away, that God would gather his people together for a great feast, to be eaten in his presence. We read earlier from Isaiah chapter 55, where the Lord invites needy people, thirsty people, people who have no money, and he invites them to come to the great feast. Come, buy wine and milk without money. It's for free. He tells them, listen to me, eat what's good. Your soul will delight in the richest affair. God offers people access to his feast. Earlier on in the book of Isaiah, the feast is described, the great feast at the end of history. This is Isaiah chapter 25. And first, Isaiah, or the Lord speaking through Isaiah, talks about God's grace to poor people, needy people, desperate people. Isaiah says to the Lord, you've been a refuge for the poor, a refuge for the needy in his distress. You've been a shelter from the storm. You've been a shade from the heat. He talks about the ruthless who have exploited the poor and the needy. And he says that their song, their rejoicing is going to come to an end, because God is going to supply all the needs of his needy, wretched people. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples. This is Isaiah 25, verse 6. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food, and it's for all peoples. God's people are drawn from all nations, and they'll all be there at this great feast. And what delights there'll be on offer then, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats, the finest of wines. Every joy, every delightful thing that God can give will be there freely on offer at the great feast. On this mountain he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove the disgrace of his people from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. What is this feast for? It's a celebration feast. It's a feast held to celebrate the abolition of death, the ending of shame, the shame that's come about through sin. God destroys the shroud of death. And God's people rejoice with him. They sit down together to enjoy forever God's goodness. You see, this feast isn't a feast that's only going to last for an hour, or even for 6 hours, or 12 hours. This is a feast that's going to go on and on and on. God's people rejoicing in God's presence, experiencing God's pleasures in God's presence. The Old Testament spoke about it. The great feast. There were feasts held every year in Israel, of course. Three times a year, Israelites from all over the land came and gathered in Jerusalem. And there they feasted together. But now all those annual feasts are fulfilled in this one great end of history. Eternal feast that God's people will enjoy together. Why do people feast? Or when do people feast? As we've said, they feast when they've got something to celebrate. It may be a victory. The nation's been at war. And during the time of war, its food supplies have been depleted. But at last, the decisive victory's been won. What do people do? They feast. They feast because victory has come. They feast when there's a coronation. Any sort of royal event. We have street parties. And people feast at them. Coronation supremely is an occasion for feasting. A wedding. We say, oh, it's natural, isn't it, that when the wedding service is over, people gather to feast together, to rejoice with the bride and the groom. The harvest. Every year there would be a feast to mark the harvest in Israel. People feast when there's something to celebrate. And this feast to be held at the end of time, this feast at which all God's people will sit, is the ultimate celebration. They are celebrating a victory. They're celebrating the final victory. They're celebrating the defeat of sin and death and Satan and the curse. It's over. It's abolished. The war's been won. And God's people gather to celebrate. They're feasting to celebrate a coronation. The moment when King Jesus steps forward to receive the praise of all the universe. Yes, he's been king ever since he ascended to the right hand of the Father. But how many of his creatures have acknowledged him as king? But now every knee bows to him. Every tongue confesses that Jesus is Lord. And his people feast to celebrate his coronation. It's a wedding feast. It's the point at which God's people are united to their true husband. When the bride of Christ comes together with the bridegroom. And so, the celebration. It's the great harvest feast. When God gathers in the harvest of his people. How he's worked to produce that harvest. And we've labored along with him. But now the harvest is all gathered in. All God's people are saved and saved. And so there's celebration, there's feasting. When Isaiah and other Old Testament writers picture the great feast at the end of time, they're talking about a great celebration. The celebration of God's victory, of Christ's coronation, of the wedding of Christ and his people, of the ingathering of the great harvest. People feast when their work is done. You don't eat big meals, do you, before you work or before you run races, because it makes you sluggish. But when your work is done, then you relax and then you sit down and then you can eat. Then you can enjoy the richest of food and the best of wines. You feast when a great sadness is lifted. You know, it's natural, isn't it, that when you are sad, when you are wretched, when you're nervous, when you're tense, you just don't want to eat. You lose your appetite. But then when the sadness is lifted, you regain that appetite. That great feast at the end of time is the feast that God's people can enjoy because all their sadness is over. Their labours are finished. They're able to sit down and just enjoy. Enjoy all that God has prepared for them. People feast when they're together. A person can binge and overeat on his own. But we don't call that a feast, do we? We don't call that a banquet. We just call that greed. In order to have a feast, you've got to have people coming together. And there's something wonderful, something delightful about people coming together and eating a wonderful meal together. You have an old boys' reunion. Or you have a girls' party before the wedding, hen night. And people get together to feast. This is the great get-together. When all of God's people from all generations, from all places, all come together around one vast table, as it were, to enjoy together the bounty of God. It's a wonderful picture of the blessings that await us. It's only a picture. As we said this morning, the reality is better than the picture. It's just that here in this world, eating, drinking are among the most acute pleasures we have. We all look forward to a feast, don't we? We all look forward to a well-prepared meal, a fantastic banquet with lots of different things on offer, prepared by a master chef. There's acute pleasure in that. So it's a natural picture for the prophets to use to talk about, oh, the pleasures that are at God's right hand forevermore, which to be lavished on his people at the end of time. That's what we mean when we talk about the great feast. We're talking about the endless joys, the endless delights that God has prepared for his people and which they'll enjoy in his presence when this world has passed away, when at last they have something to celebrate, when at last their work is done, when at last the sadness of this world has been lifted, when at last they're all together with him. That's what we mean when we talk about the great feast. And that's what Jesus is talking about here in Luke chapter 14. That's why Luke says he's telling them a parable in verse 7. He talks about feasts here on earth. And he gives lots of good advice about feasts here on earth. But the riddle is this, the parable is this, that behind all that he wants them to think about the great feast, the ultimate feast, the real feast. Here in these three parables, he's answering three questions. The first question is this: who will be honoured at God's feast? Who will be honoured at the great feast? And the answer is, the humble will be honoured at God's great feast. The people who feel unworthy, they are the people who will be honoured at the great feast. Jesus uses, as I say, the picture of any special dinner here on earth. He hides his real message in some practical advice about what to do if you're invited to a dinner, if you're invited to a wedding feast. He says, don't take the place of honour. Don't assume that you're the one who deserves to be honoured. Don't just take the best place, the place on the top table. Because otherwise you could feel embarrassed when the master of ceremony says, I'm sorry, that place isn't for you, and relegates you to the most insignificant place in the room. While he elevates, gives honour to the person who originally took the lowest place in the room. Jesus spells out the lesson in verse 11. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. He says it could happen at a dinner here on earth. Well, then it'll certainly be like that when it comes to the great feast. The people who will be honoured on that day will be the people who didn't think they were special at all. The people who never pushed themselves forward. The people who regarded themselves as unworthy. He's striking, isn't he, at these Pharisees. They were so sure that they were the people who were worthy. While a man like that man with dropsy was an outcast, was worthless. Jesus said it'll be a man like that who'll find himself at the top table. It'll be a man like that who'll be in the presence of the king, of the bridegroom, while people like you will be humiliated. Who'll be honoured at God's feast? The humble, the people who never thought of themselves as anybody special. The people who didn't feel that they deserved honour at all. The heart of man is deceitful above all things, desperately wicked. But we have to search our hearts, don't we? What do you deserve from God? What do you really believe that you deserve from God? The mark of God's elect, the mark of those who will be sitting there enjoying the presence of Jesus Christ, is that they feel that they deserve nothing from God. They go through this life just feeling totally unworthy, unworthy of his kindness, unworthy of his love, unworthy of any honour. And that's why on that day they'll be exalted. That's the first question. Who'll be honoured at God's feast? The humble, the people who feel their own unworthiness. The second question, who does God invite to his feast? Again, Jesus hides the point he's making in practical advice about meals here on earth. Jesus said to his host, the man who had made sure that he only invited people he thought was worthy to his dinner, Jesus said to his host, when you give a luncheon or dinner, don't invite your friends, your brothers or relatives or your rich neighbours. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. That was actually what the Pharisees were doing. They invited the people who they felt had something to give back to them. The people who could repay them. When you give a banquet, says Jesus, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you'll be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you'll be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. You see, Jesus gives the hint that he's not just talking about dinners here in this world. He's talking about what's going to happen at the end of the world. Why is it so important that these Pharisees should learn to invite the people who have got nothing to give in return? is because that's the way God works. That's the invitation that God sends out. God invites people who have got no way of repaying him. God invites them to the great feast. He invites the poor and the crippled and the lame and the blind. He invites the outcasts. He invites the ruined. He invites the damaged. He invites you if you're one of those people. You're invited to the great banquet. You've got nothing you can give to God. You've got nothing you can promise to God in return. You can't promise that you'll serve him. You can't promise that you'll work for him. You can't promise that you'll even feel grateful to him. Because you can't produce gratitude in your own heart. You can't promise that you'll love him because you can't make yourself love him. You've literally got nothing you can give to God. And yet he invites you. He invites you just as you are. You're poor. You'll have to come to him with empty hands saying, look, I've got nothing to give. You're crippled. You can't run to him enthusiastically because your heart doesn't feel enthusiastic towards him. You stumble towards him on crippled legs, but he still invites you. You're lame. When you have come to him, what can you actually do that's useful to him? You've got nothing you can do that he needs. But he still invites you. You're blind. Oh, you don't see his glory as you should. You don't see his goodness. You don't see how loving he is. You don't see and worship him as you should. But still he invites you. That's the way. That's the way Jesus says. That's the sort of invitation that Jesus says we should be giving to others. But why? Because that's the sort of invitation God gives to us. Nobody is barred from coming to this feast by their inability. Nobody is kept away because they don't meet the criteria, because there are no criteria. There's no standard that you have to reach in order to come to this feast. It's people who have got nothing to give, people who are capable of nothing, people who have got no strength, no goodness, no desire at times. It's those people who come. It's those people who are invited freely. And then the third question is this: who will actually be there as God's guests at God's feast? And it's very simple in the end. The people who choose to be. Jesus tells another parable in verses 15 to 24 about a great feast and a man who invites all sorts of folk to his great feast. He invites many guests. And they all say, yes, I'll come. Of course I'll come. It'd be such an honour to be at his feast. And then when the feast is ready, out go the messengers to say, right, it's all ready. And they all start making excuses. And they're feeble excuses. One says, I've just bought five yoke of oxen, and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. As if he hadn't examined the oxen before he bought them. Or as if testing these oxen couldn't wait till tomorrow. The fact is, it just wasn't that important to him to be at the feast. He didn't really want it that much. Another one makes an equally feeble excuse. The third one makes an equally feeble excuse. You see, these people are well-fed people. These are people who are who aren't hungry. They're the sort of people who do have lots of oxen. They're the sort of people who have fields. The sort of people who have stable, happy lives. They're, for them, an invitation to a banquet isn't a great thing. And so when it comes down to it, they don't want that much to be there. It's just not that important to them. They never get a taste of the banquet. But there are other people then to whom the messengers go. The poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame from the streets of the town. And then the beggars and the tramps from the hedgerows out in the country. When they hear the news that there's a banquet on offer, wow, they want to be there. They're not going to miss this opportunity. Who's going to be at the great feast? The people who want to be. The people who choose to be. The people for whom it's important because they're hungry, because they're desperate, because they've got nowhere else where they can find satisfaction. They'll accept the invitation. They'll make sure they get there. I said a moment ago that there's no qualification, no criterion that you need, except this, that you choose to be there. Do you say, yeah, I'm going to be there. I am going to be at that banquet, and I'm not going to let anything stop me from getting to that banquet. If there's a great banquet on offer, if God is willing to give me all his joys, all his pleasures, if God's willing to open up his arms and lavish everything he has on me, I'm going to make sure I'm there. What a fool a person is who throws away the opportunity to be at this banquet. You know, we get all sorts of promotional offers through the door. I expect you do too. There always seems to be another restaurant opening somewhere in the area. You know, free meal. You know, turn up on such and such an evening. Free meal. And I feel almost guilty if I turn down the opportunity for the free meal. What if you were invited to dinner with the Prime Minister? What if you were given the opportunity to sit down at his table with the Queen? You've been given an invitation to a much more wonderful meal than Dave or Her Majesty could offer you. The living God, the God of the universe, has invited you to sit down at his feast with him. What a fool you'd be to turn it down. Don't turn it down. Don't make any feeble excuses. Don't say that there are things more important. Don't say, oh, I can wait till another time to send off the acceptance. Say to him now, yes, yes, yes. I'm going to be there. And then don't let anything prevent you from being there at the great banquet. Who will be honoured at God's feast? The humble, the people who feel their own unworthiness. Who does God invite to his feast? The people who've got nothing to give and who know it. Who will actually be there at God's feast? The people who want to be. The people who choose to be. Why shouldn't that be you?